Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. It's The Takeaway, of course. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and we've been listening to some of your many and varied thoughts about police trust and the communities they serve, and we will run those comments by a former police chief later this hour. Listen for that. Also, the story of one man who was wrongfully convicted of a murder in Detroit and spent more than 9 years in jail, a wrongful conviction, a pledge of $5 million in compensation, how Detroit's bankruptcy, though, is a thicker wall than even a prison cell. We will end this hour with a lighter discussion of how technology and music make beautiful music when musicians push their instruments and gadgets and volume knobs beyond the limit.
If you can see,
yeah,
the numbers all go to 11. Look. Right across the board. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
There are no limits for the band Spinal Tap, as we know. But we're going to begin this hour with a bit of philosophy, Nigerian philosophy.
When I was a boy, they told me that everything happens for a reason. But they were wrong. Some things don't happen for a reason. Some things just happen. You might say, I'm too young to be lecturing you. But I've been through the whole circle of life, and I can tell you that this is how it goes. You get born, some things just happen, then you die.
That sense of resignation and cynicism from a Nigerian man comes from the film Confusion Na Wa. The director is Kenneth Gang, who grew up in Nigeria and who knows the religious-inspired violence in his country very well. He's in New York for the 21st African Film Festival, a festival that has had a shadow cast over it by the continuing story of the kidnapping of schoolgirls by the terrorist group Boko Haram. Kenneth Gang's film, Confusion Na Wa, was all about Nigeria's human connections, and it tells its story using a lost cell phone as a metaphor. The metaphor of people and their lost connections has added intensity now in the wake of the schoolgirl kidnappings. And Kenneth Gang wanted to speak to us about the deep sense of outrage people are feeling in his country, and a sense of powerlessness that he says defeats people and causes some to even conclude that Boko Haram and its kidnappings have become normal in Nigeria now.
This is a huge moral issue, actually, because people always feel once you are on this side of this religion and you're fighting for this religion, you feel that, okay, whatever they're doing, some people think that it's right. Of course, majority of people don't really think, but I mean, it's always supposed to be 100% against that. And apart from that, you know, like, even at government level, the whole talk about being gay, homosexuality, and things like that, where it, like, passed through parliament, if you're caught, like, being in the same sex, you have to be, you'll be jailed for, like, 14 years. You understand?
I mean, yes, I do. Yeah, it's illegal. It's illegal in Nigeria.
Yeah, it's illegal, yeah. So, I mean, all of these things, people, I think sometimes they always delve away from like what it is they need to be talking about or dealing with and like trying to put themselves, trying to see, okay, like maybe they are like the moral guardians of society, and they are not. I mean, even all these kidnappings, the people who are kidnapping us, Boko Haram, they are really thinking that, okay, what we're actually doing is morally right and we're trying to set the society straight. But I think like there's a huge gap in there.
Does it make you angry?
Of course. It does make all of us angry. I mean, a lot of young people. And the thing with this, right, this is not the first time it's happening. It happens. The government will always sweep it under the carpet. I know that's like really sensitive to say, but that is the truth. It's not the first time. Some girls were kidnapped before, and some of them were found, and some were actually pregnant or had babies in the forest while taking care of their farms. And so this one happened. And of course, the government was still slow in reacting. And that's actually why people took to social media talking about it. That's why we're all retweeting. People are writing lots of tweets. And it finally got the attention of the international community. But I mean, without that, it always makes us angry why we're always slow to react to situations like this.
What do you think will happen to those girls? Do you think they'll ever be released?
I really wish so. But I think that the more we delay all these things, the more they are really slipping away from our radar. Because what is happening is immediately they just go out there. Because some of the girls that escaped talked about how they were sexually abused that same day. So you can imagine the more it continues, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, I don't think we'll be able to get all of them back because they're all going to be taken out to various places. So it's not that they're going to be clustered in one place. So, I mean, that's what I think.
Do you have a sister?
I am actually from a family of three. I have like two sisters and I'm the only boy.
What do they say about what's going on?
Thing is, I mean, you always have to think about if it was your sister that's like there, as in kidnapped, what would you actually say? A lot of people with who think reasonably, they have one unified voice. And that's been the government needs to do something. We need protection. And kids really need to go to school without getting harassed or killed.
Why is that unified voice unable to really protect those young kids and keep the situation from spiraling out of control?
The thing is this, right? Nigeria is a really complex country. Lots of ethnic groups, lots of regions. And so, like, what is happening in the northern part of Nigeria might not really affect much what the person that is in the southern part of Nigeria. And so before people could actually come together, it takes really a long time. But right now, I think that the unified voice has actually done something by getting the international community aware of, like, what is happening. So I think that with time from this, I'm just positive that we're just going to keep on getting stronger. Because before now, we're always diverse in our views, and we don't really care about the different regions of our huge country.
So many people have spoken to us over the last few weeks about how outraged and embarrassed they are by the government's reaction, and embarrassed that the situation in Nigeria can be so brutal and chaotic. Is there a feeling of humiliation about being Nigerian these days?
Yes, I mean, there is. The truth is this, right? I saw a YouTube clip of our first lady and the way she reacted to these things, and it was really embarrassing. And I remember I was coming from Rio because I went to attend a film festival in Rio de Janeiro. And, you know, the moment my passport was seen at the airport in Paris, I became then a special case. Like, they wanted to ask me questions, talk to me, what I'm doing, what I'm getting. You understand? It all has to do with the country. And that's what we always talk about. I mean, back home, you might actually just hide, I mean, with your shame, like in your house. But then sometimes you have to just come out and see people. And how would you just be staring at people when you know that your government is really incompetent in handling some of these issues? So it's really, really embarrassing. And most of the time, they just set up committees. Oh, yeah, let's set up a committee to look into this or set up a committee to look into that. But it's not all about setting up committees. It's all about taking action. And it's action that we always need.
Whose responsibility is it to take action? Is it yours?
Yes. I mean, as a citizen, yes. It's my responsibility to take action and make sure that the government should do something. And I would say there are a lot of people who are like me out there who always do that. But we can only try. We have a commander-in-chief who is actually still supposed to hear our voice and do what is right for the citizens of the country.
Do you feel like Nigeria is a democracy right now, that you have a voice, or that it's pointless to try?
It's always pointless to try, but, I mean, we always try. We always try our best, but the democracy we practice in Nigeria is different from the democracy that is here in the United States, for instance. Like, I was just reading about a young girl who actually petitioned Coca-Cola and some of these soft drinks to take out a particular substance from a drink. Do you think that's going to happen in Nigeria? I don't really think so. So, yeah, that is the difference between our democracy and your democracy.
He's here for the 21st African Film Festival in New York City and director of the award-winning movie Confusion Na Wa, Nigerian director Kenneth Giang. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
This next story begins in a high-crime neighborhood of Detroit. Police spot a car they've been looking for and pull it over for the driver, Dwayne Province. The moment he stopped his car, the life he had always known came to an end.
I had got pulled over by the Detroit police on, it was the summer of June the 24th of 2000, coming from over my mother's house. And me and my girlfriend at the time, we was going to our home. This happened like late at night and we just got pulled over. And I thought I was getting pulled over for a traffic stop. But come to find out, I was getting pulled over because I was wanted for a murder that I didn't have nothing to do with.
Dwayne asked questions and tried to explain, but he was caught in a net. Police anxious to solve a neighborhood murder spree, and one lying witness anxious to get his own sentence reduced. Imran Syed is a Michigan attorney who investigated this incident long after Dwayne went to jail. Syed was shocked that such a weak case could result in a conviction.
There had been a series of murders in the neighborhood, roughly where Duane lived, and police were aware that these murders were connected, and they knew who had done it. It was a drug gang, the Mosleys, who were responsible in either directly or indirectly for all three of the murders. But without enough evidence or for whatever reason, charges hadn't been brought for 3 months. And what happened at that point is that a local a homeless man was picked up on a B&E offense, that's breaking and entering, and he said he knew what happened to Renee Hunter, who was one of the people that had been shot. This man's name, who claimed to be a witness, was Larry Wiley, and he said he had been at the street corner where Renee Hunter was shot, and he saw Duane and his brother pull up in a car and shoot Renee Hunter, and he said he was an eyewitness to this murder. Now, he was inherently a not credible source, given that he was testifying because he was trying to get a break in his own criminal case. He didn't want to go back to prison again, as he would admit to us years later. And he owed Duane some money, and he figured this was a good way to kill two birds with one stone.
Duane Provins spent 9.5 years in jail on a 32-to-62-year sentence until Imran Syed and his team of law students and paralegals got involved.
At the Michigan Innocence Clinic, we always suspected that they had to have known that they were running with a not credible witness and that their story didn't really add up. It was later on, though, that we got, I think, irrefutable proof that police really should have known better. I have interviewed a police officer who worked in that neighborhood, and he said he had made it known to his superiors that the Mosleys were responsible for this murder and Larry Wiley was lying. Years after the fact, we discovered documents that indicated a witness had gone to the police and said that the Mosleys were responsible. The police had said, well, didn't Provins have something to do with this? And he said, I don't know who Duane Provins is. There's no way he had anything to do with this. And in prosecuting one of the other murders, as I said, there were three that were connected. In prosecuting one of the other murders, the prosecution affirmatively argued that all three murders were connected and tied to the Mosleys. So in a sense, they were arguing in one courtroom one theory of the case that didn't implicate Duane, while in another courtroom they were arguing that Duane had committed this crime.
Duane suddenly had a case for exoneration, open and shut. The Michigan Innocence Clinic petitioned and got his release and a wrongful conviction settlement. An advisory panel looked at the case and set $5 million as the compensation for spending 9.5 years in jail. Justice? Turns out even justice sometimes has to stand in line when a city runs out of cash.
We have breaking news, very sad news about Detroit. It is official. It has become the largest U.S. city ever to file for bankruptcy.
You have the courts on your side. You have a panel saying he's owed $5 million. And then all of a sudden, it's game over, lights out.
Duane has not seen a penny and will probably never see anything like the $5 million he is owed. In a grim legal irony, his case is lost in the Detroit bankruptcy proceedings. Bankruptcy protection for Detroit will mean little or no compensation for Duane Provins, whose jail time robbed him of his kids' most important years.
Well, I could have been doing a whole host of things, you know. I could have, the main thing, I could have raised my children who I left, my kids. I had a 2-month-old, a 5-year-old, and a 6-year-old. I spent like 9.5 years in prison, and when I got out, you know, they was all teenagers.
So the time in prison, the time away from family, missing seeing your children grow up, the friends in your neighborhood, loss of freedom. The state has already decided that that's worth how much money?
Well, the state haven't decided anything yet. What had happened was we went to a case evaluation of, I think it was a board of 3 prominent lawyers and 1 retired federal judge, and they put a case evaluation on my case at $5 million.
Imran, in your view, what does Duane have here? Does he have an actual IOU for $5 million from someone, or what kind of paper is he holding here?
Yes, essentially that is what Duane has, because even though there had not been, you know, a signed, sealed, delivered document just yet, what we're talking about here is a lawsuit that had gotten to the point where Duane was not going to lose. And the city's options at this stage were going to be to take this thing to trial and have all that police wrongdoing be exposed even more, and who knows how much more stuff come out. Or they could agree to the $5 million figure that the arbitration panel came up with at the behest of the federal court that's hearing Duane's case. And, you know, obviously the city still had the option to take it to trial, but speaking to attorneys who handle cases like this all the time, that really wasn't realistically going to happen in this case.
If it went to trial and a jury had said, okay, we'll give you $5 million or we'll give you $15 million, would that IOU be of more value than what he's holding right now?
No, because he'd be actually in the exact same position. He'd still be an unsecured creditor who has money coming to him, but he's not, you know, he's not a labor union. He's not a bank. He doesn't have a seat at the table for this bankruptcy negotiation. He's just like a lot of people who, I believe it's about 500 people who have pending monetary lawsuits against the city of Detroit for everything from getting hit by a city bus and suffering losses to people like Dwayne, who, you know, were wrongfully convicted because of police misconduct.
All right. So fact, wrongfully convicted. Fact, the city was going to lose this case and be liable for as much as $5 million. That's a fact. It's also a fact that the city views your IOU, Dwayne, with the same urgency as it views, say, somebody that the city of Detroit owes for like a dry cleaning bill, right?
Yes, that's how they're looking at it. Yes. To me, they're not really giving too much thought on unsecured creditors like myself who got pending lawsuits against the city. You know, we don't get that much hoopla like the retirees and, you know, other big creditors like the banks and stuff like
right.
that.
And the reason that's happening is because different classes of creditors are treated differently in the bankruptcy proceeding, and unsecured creditors are at the bottom of the list. So banks are probably going to get as much as 90% or more of what they're owed. The retirees and the labor unions that are advocating for them are going to get as much as 75 or 80% of what they're owed, which is, you know, fair. I'm not saying they shouldn't get that. But for Dwayne, we're talking about far, far lower figures, somewhere in the 10, 15, 20% range.
Yeah, the new plan of adjustment just went down to 15% now.
So,
yeah.
So 15 cents on the dollar, that's what people are saying.
Yes.
Dwayne, when you look back at all this, what's the message?
When I look back at all of this, it was unreal. It was like a nightmare to me, you know. It was like a nightmare. And I just thank God that, you know, my family stood by my side. You know, it was just crazy, you know, what they took me through. For 8 years, you know, I was knocking on deaf ears, you know. I was, you know, doing appeals after appeals, getting denied after denial, you know. No one wasn't hearing my case. You know, when the Michigan Innocent Clinic jumped on board with the law students, it was like, you know, heaven sent, you know. It was like, you know, finally someone is listening to my case. One good thing that gave me real hope, when they came to visit me and they said they believe that I'm innocent right then and there, did that boost my confidence, that boost my hope up, you know, because now I have someone listening, you know, that's going to help me to try to get out of prison. And they prevail, you know, they got me out, you know.
Dwayne, if this was anywhere else but Detroit, what would be the outcome?
I think my case would have been settled at least about a year ago if it was anywhere but Detroit.
And I think you're saying that on personal experience, because we've actually seen other cases that are very similar to his that do get settled very quickly.
Very quickly.
And so if this was anywhere else but Detroit, you'd have $5 million or so in the bank, period, the end.
Yes, I would have my apology from the Detroit police. I look at that lawsuit, I look at that $5 million as an apology to me and my family, because when I was exonerated, when I walked out those prison doors, I didn't get any apology from anyone, not from the prosecutor, not from the Detroit police, or nothing like that. You know, it would just open the door, they let me out, and that was it.
Dwayne, do you ever feel like you are just the unluckiest fellow on planet Earth? How do you keep from feeling that?
Well, I don't feel unlucky. I feel like I'm the luckiest man on the planet because I have my freedom now. As you know, I was looking at 32 to 62 years in prison. And if it wasn't for the Michigan Innocent Clinic and the law students who fought by my side from tooth to nail, I'll be in prison right now until 2032. And hopefully then I can get a parole then. So, you know, I feel like I'm lucky to be out, to have good friends, you know, who believed in me, who fought for me, you know, who got me out and got me back home to my family and my children. I'm home.
Dwayne Provence and Imran Syed, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Imran Syed is a staff attorney at the Michigan Innocence Clinic, part of the team that helped free Dwayne Provence after he was wrongfully imprisoned. Imran is also currently working on a documentary about Dwayne's case. To learn more about the project, go to thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Two developments now in Syria's civil war. After months of being under siege, the opposition in the city of Homs was forced to give up this week and abandon the city to government forces. Meanwhile, today, the Syrian government may have been the target of a massive explosion at a historic hotel in the city of Aleppo. Joining us now on the line is Anne Bernard, Beirut bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Anne, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So what's the significance of this hotel, and is there any sort of strategic implication of this being the target?
Well, the hotel is a landmark in the old city of Aleppo near the citadel. And this is a significant place just in terms of the history and architecture of the city. Also, this is near the front line between rebel and government forces. Lately, rebel groups have carried off several spectacular explosions in Aleppo and also in Idlib province by tunneling underneath buildings where they said troops were billeted. That said, I did just see state television's correspondent at the scene, and I didn't see any flurry of rescue operations there, which made me wonder whether perhaps there were not as many troops in the building as the insurgents have said.
The symbolic significance of this as a target suggests that even though there was a withdrawal and an abandonment of the city of Homs, that the opposition intends to take this fight directly to the Syrian military in places like Damascus and Aleppo. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes, I don't think the withdrawal from the old city of Homs means that insurgents are giving up. I think that was a particular case where it benefited both sides in different ways to get those people out, and there was a specific agreement made, but it was not part of any broader negotiated framework or step towards ending the conflict. It was simply tactical.
What can the government say about its ability to hold on here? I mean, from their perspective, the withdrawal from Homs is something of a victory, at least a victory for the tactic of the use of siege.
That's right. In fact, the insurgents are complaining that having been left without help either from other fighting groups inside Syria or from the outside world, they were forced to submit to these kinds of tactics. And I think that the government's hope is that through these tough tactics, as well as local talks and negotiations, they can make local ceasefires to calm the situation enough to be able to say we don't need any outside help or intervention to end this crisis. But that doesn't address any of the underlying issues that started this conflict with political protests more than 3 years ago.
The Syrian conflict, simmers out of the view of the world, and then something very, very violent can happen to bring it center stage. And I'm wondering if people are worried that either the government or the opposition will try to do something to get people to pay more attention, something that could involve Syrian civilians.
Well, I think Syrian civilians have been bearing the brunt throughout this conflict, and certainly it's unpredictable. Each side has continued to use new weapons and tactics that continue to make life worse for civilians. So there's always that possibility. Right now, there have been allegations that the government has started to use chlorine in bombs in Hama province and elsewhere. Again, this isn't killing nearly as many people as the tactic of aerial bombardments of areas. In fact, this bombing today was carried out by the Islamic Front, who made a statement saying this was in response to the bombardment of Aleppo neighborhoods held by insurgents by the government, which has killed scores of civilians lately.
So no chance or sign that anything is going to significantly change here. This standoff continues.
That's right.
Anne Bernard is Beirut bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Looking at some good news when that can be hard is the mission of some of our colleagues out in Phoenix, Arizona this month. The reporters of KJZZ News in Phoenix decided to explore the upside of what people in their city decide to throw away. Their trash-talking series is called The Rubbish Project, And in the midst of a miserable start for the Arizona Diamondbacks baseball team, news director Peter O'Dowd found that the D-backs have embraced a zero-waste initiative to distract people from their nearly zero-runs record.
The Diamondbacks are not having a good year, but we did go to the stadium recently to learn about all the trash that they're throwing away. Every single game, the Diamondbacks say, if it's a well-attended game, 10 tons of garbage is created. So if you multiply that by an 81-game home season, you know, throughout the major leagues all over the country, imagine how much trash is being created at Major League Baseball stadiums.
This is a pretty visible way of addressing an issue that affects cities all over the United States.
Right. And in fact, there's this thing that the Diamondbacks are a part of, which is the Green Sports Alliance. It's got about 106 teams across the country. For instance, the Cleveland Browns have been testing out this project where it's this big food disposal program that grinds up the unused food from the stadium, makes it into a slurry so that it can eventually produce this biofuel. The D-backs, for instance, are also mulching the grass clippings from the outfield. They're donating unused food to food banks. They even, you know, are making some of their staff shirts out of recycled plastic bottles.
Part of the motivation for this series that you're doing is really to note the newbies in this recycling and no waste phenomenon, but also the long-standing businesses that really have made a brand identity of recycling and reusing things. What have you found?
So, for instance, the aluminum can recycling industry, I think this is something fascinating that we discovered. You know, we wondered what happened when you put a beer can in the recycler. What happens to it? Where does it go? Well, it turns out in the city of Phoenix, the city will collect these cans. They don't offer any redemption value or anything like that. They crush the cans, they package them, but then they send them out of state. So a can that you recycle in Arizona is not even processed here. It's put on a truck and sent to beverage companies where they are usually reprocessed there. We found something interesting as well, that a lot of these cans are going to California. People are selling cans that were not purchased in the state, but they're taking the redemption value for these aluminum cans. So 5, 10 cents, depending on what the can is and what it's made of. And so there's this fraud problem that California is trying to get a handle on, of people, you know, redeeming hundreds of thousands of dollars over the course of time for cans that had nothing to do with California.
One of the things you discovered is how in the community, groups like Goodwill and St. Vincent de Paul are doing a lot of innovative and interesting things and unexpected things with some of the donations that come in. What have you found?
Yeah, that's right. So another question we had is, what happens when you donate something to Goodwill and it's complete junk? You know, it's something that is no way going to sell in the thrift shops, and you still put it on the doorstep there and hope that they'll have something to do with it. Well, it turns out that about, you know, 10% of the stuff that you're sending to, you know, St. Vincent de Paul, for instance, they say 10% of that stuff that you give them, they just can't do anything with. One of the things that they try to do is every morning in Phoenix anyways, they have this auction where buyers from all over the state will come to buy scrap metal, old luggage that is totally useless otherwise.
It's kind of a field day for hoarders in a sense.
For the most part, we have a buyer that'll buy just about everything. Luggage, baseball caps, pots and pans, utensils. The list goes on and on. We sell everything. Some of it's baled and some of it we sell in sacks.
It's Mike Dezino, who works for Goodwill. Have you been tempted with any of this stuff?
You know, the one thing that I took away from this, especially on the Goodwill story, is that even if you have this, like, pit-stained, nasty shirt in your closet that's been sitting there for 15 years and your wife's been, you know, telling you to get rid of it, they will actually find something to do with that shirt. So I think that's my takeaway. I'll let the junk stay in the warehouse, but it feels good to know that if I'm dropping something off at the doorstep of Goodwill, that hopefully they'll find something to do with it.
That is good. Peter O'Dowd, news director for KJZZ in Phoenix. Let's hope the fortunes of the Diamondbacks turn around, Peter.
Thanks a lot.
You know, occasionally on this program, we will seek your view of events that we may be seeing in the news, wondering if there might be a pattern or an underlying passion that people might be feeling. And regularly, your reactions surprise and guide us to seek a broader conversation. And such was the case yesterday when, in response to the story of a police shooting down in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and the turmoil and protest it has created in that community, we asked, how much or how little do you trust the police? We received an enormous number of responses. Nothing scientific about that, and nothing to argue with some national numbers from the Gallup organization that show that for the past 20 years, the police have enjoyed a high level of trust. 57% in last year's survey expressed a great deal or quite a lot of trust in the police. But in the reactions from you, we realize that all trust of law enforcement, like all politics in that famous phrase, is local. So we reached out to Norm Stamper, a former Seattle police chief who is now an outspoken civilian advocate for police reform. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Norm.
It's good to be with you.
So all law enforcement trust is pretty local. It really depends on who it is you're looking at any given moment in a community, right?
Yeah, there are up to 20,000 law enforcement agencies in this country, and any given day, in the wake of any given event, you're going to see those trust levels fluctuating from one community to another, across state lines, throughout the country.
Let me give you a smattering of responses that we got yesterday. Park City, Utah, I trust the police because I want to trust them. I believe my feelings would be different if I was a person of color or a lower socioeconomic status person. Or Austin, Texas, I guess I trust them implicitly, and perhaps that's not very wise. Here's something a little bit more negative. Listen to this listener here.
I think we all have moments with the police, and no, I don't trust them at all, but there is a lot of favoritism, and what they try to cover up for one, okay, they imprison the other one for it. So we all know it happens. It's just there. It's like a fact of life.
Now, I don't want you to respond to Erin, and she's from New Jersey. I don't want you to respond to her particular accusation there, but when you hear stuff like that, what is the responsibility of law enforcement to either jump in and correct the situation or, you know, what do you think that means?
Well, the first responsibility, as I see it, is to listen to Erin and every other person out there who mistrusts or distrusts the police and to listen without defensiveness. I think people are expressing honest, heartfelt opinions, many of them shaped by media coverage of a particular event, some of them by personal experience or the even vicarious personal experience through family members or friends. And so I think the first order of business is for the police to listen to that, take it in, and understand that while many blindly support the police, there are some, if not many, who have very serious reservations or animosity toward the police.
Let me give you an example of someone who is actually from your neck of the woods, who gave us one of these personal experiences that seems to have had an impact, perhaps a permanent impact, on his whole orientation towards law enforcement. Listen.
Hi, this is Michael from Seattle. About 5 years ago, when I was robbed at gunpoint, I didn't feel safe until the police arrived and really put my trust in police. However, when I was arrested and other interactions with the police, I did not trust them, not one bit. They lied in court. They lied to my face. It's a love and hate relationship that I have.
Now, what do you think of that story, a love and hate relationship there, Norm?
Well, I think that caller pretty much nails it. When you want and need the police, there's no more comforting a presence than that black and white, or in the case of Seattle or New York or a variety of other cities, that blue and white showing up. Stepping out of that conspicuously marked automobile would be a uniformed police officer who is authorized and trained to help people in times of need. I think of police dealing with individuals who are oftentimes not at their best. So the first order of business, I think, is to somehow not simply persuade police officers, but train police officers to look for signs of individuals who are under the influence of a mind or mood altering substance, under the influence of mental illness, under the influence of normal human emotions in, for example, domestic dispute situations, which often turn violent. So we get police officers to recognize that is a normal condition for them. I think policing demands a partnership, an authentic partnership between police officers and the communities they serve. I think of a 50-50 proposition. In other words, if you and I are partners and you do something significant without consulting with me, without sharing your reasons for doing it, we're gonna have a very strained partnership. Now, it needs to be said, if a police officer is experiencing what he or she sees as a life-threatening situation, we don't hold a seminar on that. We don't join hands and sing kumbaya. What we do is cultivate the strongest possible relationship and partnership between those events so that when they happen, it might be police use of lethal force, it might be a WTO protest or an Occupy protest.
And you had direct experience with those kinds of protests there in Seattle. Before you go, why don't you assess the partnership challenges for the people of Albuquerque who are going to have to deal with the consequences of the use of lethal force?
Well, yeah, both police officers and the citizens of Albuquerque who read the papers, watch television, view those YouTubes, see incidents over and over and over again. And that can produce entrenchment within the police culture. It can produce entrenchment within the ranks of critics. What has to happen is somehow forging common ground and doing a whole lot of listening and exhibiting the kind of respect that's necessary for any healthy partnership.
Norm Stamper has been helping us with all of your responses to the question of how much do you trust the police in your own community. He's a former Seattle police chief in 1999 when the World Trade Organization protesters clashed with police on the streets of Seattle. Norm, thanks so much.
It was my pleasure.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
So you start with the pure note of a brass horn playing Telemann. And you have Miles Davis push that trumpet to the limit. And a new kind of music is born. Or take the simple idea of amplifying the pure string notes of a guitar so it can play along with louder instruments. Then let Jimi Hendrix and his speedy fingers push the knobs beyond the technical limits of a tube amp, and you get another new sound for a new kind of music. When I was growing up, the rule was don't touch Dad's turntable playing vinyl records. It and then do this when Daddy isn't looking, and another music is born.
Get back on your feet, please. I'm begging you to check.
But this idea of music pushing technology, pushing music, pushing technology, is the premise of a series reporter and host Ben Johnson has been doing this week on APM's Marketplace Tech called Playing with Machines. Ben, welcome.
Thank you, John.
So you start playing music, you pick up a machine. It's called an instrument, right? That's the oldest thing in the world.
Absolutely. It's something that musicians have been doing for tens of thousands of years. But what's really interesting is some musicians are starting to actually start with really sort of complicated machines in order to get into music. One of the people that we talked to, his name is John Powell. He's a film composer. He's done over 50 movies. But he sort of takes his year zero moment for his musical career and connects it to a gaming console.
If this was 1986, probably when I got out of music college, I was still working, you know, on tape machines with everything that everybody else had. And suddenly along came the Atari ST1080, which was obviously a gaming system, but some neat guys in Germany figured out how to get some really good sequences into that hardware. That was the beginning for me of really being able to work in a fluid way. The difference between working on paper and having a computer is the speed at which you can work.
So I remember the old Fender Telecaster. He remembers the old Atari ST1080.
Huh? Yeah, and programming music from that, which is, I think, really interesting.
And this way of dealing with music as a medium, uh-huh. not necessarily as a virtuoso experience, also informs some of the other people that you talk to who became musicians by the way they collected music.
Absolutely. One of the people we talked to was DJ Reka. She's a DJ and label owner in New York City, and she's credited with bringing Bhangra music to the U.S. This is a form of Indian folk music. She basically, in her community in Long Island, growing up, everyone had VCRs. They were taping Bhangra music. They were illegally sort of dubbing Bollywood movies. And that, for her, is how she first got introduced to some of this music herself and started to incorporate it into her music later on.
Every Indian American household had a VCR first because the movies were important, watching the Bollywood films. And in the 90s, there was a huge Indian Bollywood remix scene, taking Bollywood records without getting the original parts and putting beats on them.
A Bollywood remix scene. What sorts of machines do you use to make that happen? You start with the VCR, but...
Eventually it came to CDs and CDRs, and she used a lot of those and, was passing some of that stuff around and was using it as a DJ. And as her own DJ equipment started to evolve and she started moving from turntables to CD turntables, she started using some of these remixes.
So part of this is about mixing and using materials in ways that they've never been used before to develop new music. And part of it is also just literally pushing it beyond the limits, just taking the technical specs and throwing that out.
Totally. And you and I, we both play a little bit of music. We both know the experience of playing a wrong note and actually kind of liking that wrong note.
I mostly play wrong notes.
As do I. But one of the people we talked to, her name is Meryl Garbus, and she's the lead singer behind the band Toon Yards. And she's sort of known for actually, in a way, treating herself like a machine. She records herself performing as a human and then loops those recordings and then plays along with them and layers them and things like that. But on her new album, she had a different approach, and it had to do with playing drum machines with her hands and seeing how the machine actually reacted when she kind of messed up.
In our latest album, I tried to use the drum machine so fast that sometimes it couldn't read my fingertip fast enough, and it would come out with different permutations of that rhythm. You know, instead of diddle it, diddle it, diddle it, diddle it, it comes out as diddle it, diddle it, diddle it, diddle it, diddle it, diddle it.
So that's so cool, right? She's discovering a new musical idea by making the drum machine trip over itself.
But it's a little bit like what Liszt did on the piano, what Paganini did on the violin. It's really pushing it to the limit and discovering something fundamentally new. But in this case, the virtuosity is not necessarily physical. It's psychological.
Absolutely. And one of the other people that we talked to who is really interesting is this electronic artist called Square Pusher. He's this guy. He's known for really pushing the limit in drum programming and all kinds of things like that. His latest album it's called Music for Robots. It's written for a band of three robots built by Japanese roboticists. And you got to see these things. They look like people, basically. They looks like a person sitting behind the drum set, sort of looks like a guitar player, but the guitar player has 73 fingers and it can play 100 notes within a second. So take a listen to this.
Whoa, Hendrix wishes he has 73 fingers.
Absolutely. And, it's crazy to watch. I mean, this thing is going a mile a minute, and it's really impressive. but you can sort of feel the mechanics of it, right? And it's, you know, there's a question there of whether or not it's really emotional.
Is this music or is this a Disney stunt?
Well, it's interesting. You know, Squarepusher, he's also known as Tom Jenkinson, he said that this project for him was about trying to discover whether machines could play something that got an emotion out of a human listener. And he said to me, he was a little coy about it, but he said to me he wouldn't have put the recording out if he didn't think the recording answered that question.
Ben Johnson, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, John.
Ben Johnson is the host of the APM Marketplace Tech Program. His series this week is called Playing with Machines. Tomorrow on the show,
we try to instill in them a sense of self-worth, of self-responsibility, respect for others, and love of mankind.
Growing up Tyson, Neil deGrasse Tyson, that is, Sanchita Tony Tyson, mother of the astro celebrity Force of Nature, joins us to celebrate Mother's Day. You may still be grappling with what to get your mom. What did she give to you? Tell us at thetakeaway.org or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Hi, Mom. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.